You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 9th, 2013, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
How the hell are things?
Quite well.
Good.
Super.
Becca, you're over your jet lag?
I am. Just long enough to before I fly out to Seattle again next week.
Oh, boy.
If people are going to be in Seattle next week, come see me at Geek Girl Con. It's the 19th and 20th in Seattle.
Geek Girls, huh?
Yeah. I was there last year. It was a lot of fun. So we're going to have a skeptic table there this year. Hey, speaking of none of that, did you know?
That's whatever you're talking about for you.
I have to teach you how to segue, Rebecca.
I don't know. I think speaking of none of that works very well for
it's
me.
It's one of those scooters you ride around on the Segway.
On October 10th, 1871, the Great Chicago Fire was finally doused after raging for several days since October 8th. And it was only put out thanks to rain coming in. So you guys have heard of the Great Chicago Fire, right?
Oh, yeah. Couple times.
Mrs. O'Leary's cow knocking over the lantern. There was a song. I don't really remember how it goes, but it was about the cow knocking over the lantern. Anyway, that's all false.
Well, it was never proven. You can't prove that it wasn't her cow, but...
Well, it would be an amazing coincidence if it was her cow, because the reporter who reported that it was Mrs. O'Leary's cow... just 20 years later, I think, admitted to making it up out of whole cloth. Nobody really knows how the fire started.
No, it did, but it did start at the O'Leary's.
Yeah, and it did start in a barn near the O'Leary's place. There have been several creative possibilities suggested. The more plausible ones being like, well, somebody... knocked over a lantern or something. It wasn't Mrs. O'Leary's cow, but apparently someone may have been in the barn stealing milk at the time and they might have done it. But my favorite suggestion came from some astronomers who suggested that because there were several other fires throughout the city that same weekend, there was a suggestion that it could have been meteorites breaking up in the atmosphere and hitting various parts of Chicago and setting them all alight.
Yeah, but well, meteorites aren't hot.
There's one very obvious problem with this, and that is, yeah, when meteorites hit the ground, they tend to be cold from going through the atmosphere. So, yeah, that hasn't really caught on. But there was a meteor shower at the time. So, yeah, now it's more likely that those other fires were... just related in that there was a drought going on, so there were very dry conditions, and there was a sudden windstorm that came up. So conditions were just ripe for a fire to happen. And it did. Quite a large fire. Burned for 3 days.
Apparently the firefighters also went to the wrong neighborhood at first, so they were delayed in getting to the O'Leary's, and that might have let the fire spread out of control. And it was basically too late to get it under control. And as you say, it really didn't go out until it started raining 2 days later.
The cleanup from the fire, they pushed so much debris into the ocean, or I'm sorry, into the Great Lakes right there, that it actually made the city bigger. There was more area for them to move the city into. They built right on top of all that debris.
Yeah, it gutted the city, completely devastated the financial district.
And one third of the population was left homeless as a result.
100,000 people.
Yep, hundreds of people were killed, and it took out about 3 square miles, I think, in total.
Yeah, can you imagine?
But they're doing all right today. They recovered.
Yeah, they're fine.
Yeah, they had that little dalliance with Al Capone there for a while, but now they're doing good.
And that whole sausage thing. But I think they've recovered from that.
That's basically the history of Chicago.
Chicago.
The fire, Capone, sausage, and now modern day. All right. Well, it's that time of year again, guys.
It is?
The 2013 Nobel Prizes have been
2013.
Announced. Those two. All right, wise guy, you want to tell us about the physics prize?
I think you guys would agree that this was pretty much inevitable. The Nobel Prize in Physics has been awarded for the discovery of the Higgs boson. But didn't this happen sooner than you expected?
But I mean, Peter Higgs, for whom the Higgs boson is named for, you know, you have to win the award. You have to be alive to win the award. And I think they were perhaps
to be nominated.
Trying to make sure, or to be nominated.
Yeah, they now allow, sure, if you die after you're nominated, they can still give you the award.
Yeah. As I'm sure a lot of you guys know, the Higgs boson was theorized in the 60s, but only since around my birthday in July 2012 did the experimental evidence reach a confidence level that was sufficient to say, yep, we're pretty sure we found the Higgs particle, or at very least a very Higgs-like particle. This, of course, is the particle or its field that's responsible for the mass that matter exhibits. So, yeah, it's kind of important. But the recipient was just not Higgs, though. Physicist Peter Higgs, of course, is the namesake of the particle. He now has a Nobel for it, but so does Francois Englert. He published independently a similar theory only a few weeks after Peter Higgs.
Psych.
Yeah, right. can you say Wallace? Posthumously and metaphorically standing with him was Robert Brout, who was Francois's colleague, who also worked with Francois on this. And then there were three other physicists who did not receive the prize, but they also made key contributions to the theory. They were Gerald Gerlnick, Tom Kibble, and Carl Hagen. They were there at the ceremony and were given an opportunity to talk about the discovery back in last year, in 2012. I thought that was nice that they included them, even though they couldn't really give it to them as well. Hagen made some comments about the naming of the particle in the past, not necessarily at the ceremony, but he has been known to talk about his distaste for Higgs's rock star status. Peter Higgs himself, I know, Peter Higgs himself has expressed annoyance. He seems like a class act, this guy. He prefers to call it the scalar boson. And I kind of agree. But if it's one thing the science community needs, I think, is more scientists with rock star status. Am I right? I mean, they need to be our heroes. You know, we need more science heroes. You know,
yeah.
More Carl Sagan's and there's not too many, you know, there's a lot of them, but there's not enough. So I can't begrudge him any rock star status he got from it.
Yeah, come on. An elementary particle is famous. I mean, come on, go with it.
And I think the problem, though, is the problem that's currently being discussed because of this Nobel Prize in particular. It's been a really interesting conversation to follow online. It's the problem with the Nobel Prizes as a whole, which is that it elevates individual scientists when more and more we're living in a world where collaborative science is where all of the big discoveries are happening. But in the case of the Higgs boson, the Nobel Prize is being awarded to the theoretical physicists instead of the hands-on physicists who are doing the actual work of proving these theories. And so it's elevating one field of physics over another. And that's resulted in some really interesting and sometimes spirited conversations online from physicists who are working at CERN or other places who are doing the hands-on work, who would like to see that work rewarded in the hopes of encouraging people to fund that work and maybe go on to do that work as opposed to just, you know, focusing on the theory.
We call that the Sheldon Cooper effect.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Rebecca, I totally agree. There actually was some controversy and a lot of talk about, you know, why didn't they at least, throw in CERN, you know, the laboratory CERN in there with Peter Higgs and Francois, maybe. That was certainly an option. The Peace Prize, awards it to organizations. They've done that in the past, but it's never been done for any of the real scientific prizes. And a lot of people are thinking they really should because it is such an immensely collaborative effort.
At the same time, though, I think there's something to be said about, you know, when you say these 20 or 100 people were involved, and it kind of waters it down in a way.
I agree. I think that there's definitely an upside to, from a PR angle, of, you know, having a face of science. But at the same time, I think if you actually want to encourage people to go into the sciences and to work in the sciences, then I think it's helpful to give them a truer picture of what that is like. On the other hand, if you are hoping to inspire people to fund the sciences and support the sciences, then again, I think it's helpful for people to know that when you're funding science, you're not funding this lone rock star genius. You're funding thousands, hundreds of thousands of talented, hardworking scientists who are doing seemingly boring tasks in a laboratory. You know, I think the general public needs to understand that, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And there's another interesting angle to this. If your goal is merely, penetration into the public consciousness, then you could seriously make an argument that the God particle was the most successful name of all.
Yeah.
I want to end with a Peter Higgs quote. He said, "I hope this recognition of fundamental science will help raise awareness of the value of blue sky research." And I totally agree.
Yeah, I do agree with that. Mm-hmm. All right, we got physiology or medicine. This prize goes to three gentlemen, James Rothman, Randy Scheckman, and Thomas Sudoff, all involved in researching the machinery that cells use to move stuff around, essentially the transport system within cells. So all cells make stuff, proteins, enzymes, transmitters, hormones, and that stuff needs to be moved to different parts of the cells, or sometimes excreted from the cell to the outside. And the location and timing of this transport is critical to cell function and bodily function. And also, errors in this transport system are the source of various diseases, so it was a critical thing to understand. Essentially, Scheckman discovered the genetic mechanisms by which cells package stuff in vesicles, little bubbles surrounded by membrane, and move it around the cell. Rothman discovered the mechanism by which these vesicles fuse with the membrane of the cell and dump their cargo outside of the cell, which is that this is something that I know about in detail because I use Botox, and Botox interrupts those proteins.
I never would have guessed.
Yeah, you look great, Steve.
Where do you inject it?
Well, I use it for migraines and neurological indications. But Botox, what botulinum toxin does is it cleaves the snare proteins. The snare proteins are the proteins that are on the vesicles and the inner cell wall. They essentially grab onto each other. They bring the vesicle to the wall, allowing it to fuse and then release its cargo. You snare those proteins, you can't release neurotransmitter into the neuromuscular junction, and it paralyzes the muscle. It also works for other neurotransmitters. So that is what Rothman discovered. And then Sudoff discovered how neurotransmitters time their release, how nerve cells time the release of neurotransmitters. He discovered the connection between the incoming nerve signal, the influx of calcium, and how that influx of calcium triggers the release of the vesicles containing the neurotransmitter, passing the signal on to the next neuron. So three different aspects of vesicular function, of transport function within cells.
Steve, how come when you inject Botox into someone, it doesn't damage them?
Because the proteins regrow. Takes 3 months, and then the proteins just regrow.
But what if you injected that into somebody's bloodstream?
They would get botulism.
Ooh.
And they would, not good. Yeah, they would be sick. But it was a one-time, I mean, you could give a lethal dose, I suppose, but like if you're injecting it therapeutically and you accidentally inject into a vein, which has happened, never to me, but I'll emphasize, but that's like there are case reports of that happening. You get botulism for a couple of days. Get them into the hospital. The problem is that you could stop breathing because it paralyzes your respiratory muscles.
Ooh, I hate when that happens.
Yeah. All right, and then let's move on to the 2013 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. This also goes to three scientists. This is interesting. This goes to Martin Karplus, Michael Levitt, and Ari Warshall for developing the software to model chemical reactions, enzymes, ion channels, viruses, DNA. Not the only ones to work on this, but they were critical in developing the software that helps us model these processes. Apparently the key insight that they had, chemical models, computer models, essentially treat molecules as if the atoms are balls and their connections are springs. which is obviously an oversimplified model of how molecules really work. That model breaks down when it comes to chemical reactions, because they couldn't account for, an actual chemical reaction. They had to come up with some other way to do that. There are quantum effects, in terms of the electrons, et cetera, that had to be modeled. And so these guys came up with the computer model for that. And of course, if you're modeling chemicals, modeling the reactions that they undergo is obviously hugely important.
They started working on this in the 1970s, which was an age in which computers were not quite the most sophisticated things, especially modern standards.
They emphasize how early on they really were struggling with the very slow computer technology of the time. Let's move on. Evan, you're going to tell us about how Kansas is once again distinguishing themselves scientifically.
Well, this time it's good news, everyone. The state of Kansas has joined 6 other states in adopting the Next Generation Science Standards, also known as the NGSS. The NGSS are a comprehensive and coordinated science curriculum for children in grades kindergarten right up through grade 12. So ages about 5 to 18, you're covered here. These science standards were developed by the National Research Council, the National Science Teachers Association, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and an organization called ACHIEVE, which I had never heard of before. ACHIEVE is a bipartisan nonprofit organization that helps states raise academic standards and improve assessments and strengthen accountability to prepare young people for post-secondary education work and citizenship. So very good work they're doing. But when I first read about this, one of the first questions that crossed my mind was, is this part of the controversial Common Core state standards? Those are federal standards for math and literacy skills, which have been adopted by 45 of our 50 states. And one of the primary concerns of Common Core, frankly, what should be the overriding concern as far as I'm concerned, is does it work, right? Do children actually benefit from a national set of teaching standards? So I looked into NGSS a little further, and my concerns were somewhat alleviated when I found out it's not part of the Common Core standards. And Next Gen stands on its own. It really does.
So just for background, in the United States, the states really have control over education. The only time the federal government gets involved is through funding. So along with federal funding comes federal strings. They could tell you that if you're going to accept federal funding for your educational system, then you have to abide by these rules. But they generally have been very deferential to the states, in terms of regulating education. This move does rankle states' rights advocates, because any kind of centralized recommendations like this, they say, is an imposition on the local school districts, local, state and local boards of education, and their rights to determine how to teach their own citizens. But of course, we're talking about science here. Science standards, there's no reason to reinvent the wheel 50 times. This is, at the K through 12 level, we should be teaching very basic, consensus-driven, non-controversial science. This is not the kind of thing that every state needs to figure out for themselves. They still need to adopt the standards, but, having a group of scientific organizations say, here are some recommended standards for you, that's actually really helpful.
And that's the thing, Steve. I mean, every time you hear about someone objecting to something like this and citing states' rights, I think states' rights is usually just a smokescreen for creationism or for anti-scientific beliefs. That's what seems to be happening every time we see something like this come up.
Yeah, I agree. It's a proxy issue that they're using when what they really care about is, hey, we don't want evolution taught in Kansas.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, here's some bad news. A group of Kansas parents have sued the Board of Education in Kansas for adopting these standards, which was almost predictable. I guess nobody should be surprised by this. The lawsuit states that the adoption of NGSS by Kansas, and I quote, will have the effect of causing Kansas public schools to establish and endorse a non-theistic religious worldview in violation of the establishment, free exercise, and free and speech clauses of the First Amendment and the equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment.
Wrong. Sorry. Thanks for playing.
So science is a religion? Huh?
It's ridiculous.
I hate that.
It's the science is religion gambit that creationists will not let go. You know, it's one of their cards in their deck. They just, the fact that it's completely wrong does not dissuade them from playing it any chance they get. It, you know, it's philosophically just naive, and I don't think they really even care that it's not philosophically legitimate. Science does not require any worldview. It just follows a certain set of methods. You don't have to believe anything to do science. You just have to follow methodological naturalism. And in fact, philosophers specifically distinguish between methodological naturalism, which is just following the methods of science, which basically means that you're assuming cause and effect, that cause and effect exists in the universe. There's nothing magical. You can't invoke magic in scientific arguments, but it doesn't require that you actually believe that there is nothing magical in the universe, so-called philosophical naturalism. Science is not about belief. Religion is about belief. Science is not about belief. It's about a set of methods. That's it. So it's categorically not a worldview. It is not a religion. It's absurd. And again, you know, philosophers have completely demolished that argument hundreds of years ago. But again, that doesn't stop them from bringing it up.
Let's hope this gets thrown out early in the courts, and perhaps prior federal cases involving or related to this will serve as a precedent to allow that to happen.
Man, you know, if they think it's a religion, then they shouldn't practice it. You know, they should go live on an island and separate themselves from science and all the fruits of science and technology. If it's such an evil religion, then go ahead.
Let's move on to another controversy, this one within science itself. Rebecca, I understand that Science Magazine ran a little sting operation against open access journals.
Indeed, they did, in a rather entertaining display. They made up, so a researcher, John Bohannon, for Science, wrote a fake research paper that included several... Well, he wrote one that was changed slightly several hundreds of times.
Very clever.
Yeah. 304 versions of a paper about a wonder drug, a possible cancer-curing substance that he claimed to have found. And the paper included several huge problems that he said should have been obvious to anyone with higher than a high school level knowledge of chemistry. He submitted it, so 304 times, 304 different open access journals using different names and different made-up institutes, like one name was Okorafu Kobange, of the WASI Institute of Medicine. And
his orchestra.
This took up the past 10 months. And what he found was that an astounding number of open access journals accepted his fake paper without any peer review, without any question. I think it was about 50% of the papers the journals he submitted to accepted it. He has a really interesting breakdown that you can read. We'll link to it in the notes. It's a long read, but it's fascinating. And it goes into all of the different targets he chose and what the paper actually read, what the problems with it actually were. And also he breaks down how the different journals responded to the report. He says by the time this issue of Science went to press, 157 of the journals had accepted the paper, 98 rejected it. 29 of the journals he submitted it to seemed to be just completely defunct. He never heard back. And there were another 20 that he was still waiting on a response for. And he found that of the 255, I'll just read directly from his article. Of the 255 papers that underwent the entire editing process to acceptance or rejection, about 60% of the final decisions occurred with no sign of peer review. So it's not looking good. It's pretty damning for peer review journals, for open access journals. But it's not really surprising. You know, this has been sort of known for some time. Years ago, there was math gen and sci gen generators that would automatically create a gibberish paper on science or mathematics that you could submit to. I think SciGen was originally made so that you could submit it to conferences that asked you to attend in case you were worried that they were bogus conferences. You could just have this generator make a paper, send it along. If it was accepted, you knew that the conference was not to be trusted. So this isn't just something that's wrong with open access, you know. This has long been a problem in the scientific community. Print journals have also had their share of crap studies that have been published. The arsenic paper, arsenic life form paper, is a recent, very high profile example, but there have been many more. So, you know, in the end, I'm not shocked by this. And I think even the numbers are not surprising, like the idea that 50% of these journals are not doing their jobs when it comes to peer review, not terribly surprising, because, you know, we've always had this problem. Now, open access, the idea with the internet being there, you know, anybody can create a journal if they want and start charging money for people to send in papers. Open access means that you have to get your money from somewhere. So because, oh, I should explain this to listeners who don't know. Open access journals means that you as a user could go and read a paper in full without needing to pay a fee. Often if you go to PubMed or something, you can read abstracts of papers. But if you want to read the whole paper, you're going to have to pay a rather substantial fee, or more likely you'll have a subscription through your college or university, or through your job. If you're a scientist, you can get it then. Open access is great on the one hand, because, you know, you as an average person can look up someone's citation, you can read the paper, you can see if the actual study is any good. But at the same time, this means that open access journals need to make their money from somewhere, because they're not making it from readers. So often they make this money by charging a submission fee. So I'll publish your paper if you pay $500 or something, which is worth it for a scientist wanting to get their research out there in some way, and they want to get into some prestigious journal. That could be worth it. But if it's a crap journal that is not at all respected, then you're just flushing $500 down the toilet. But yeah, so that's the business model we're talking about. And so obviously that is ripe for being abused by somebody who could set up a fake journal, start charging hundreds of dollars to publish naive scientists' papers, and raking in the cash. I think what all this means is that, look, scientists have to be wary of where they're submitting their research, and we all need to be more cognizant of what the crap journals are. And you know, I don't think there's any stopping it. And I certainly hope that this doesn't get in the way of open access as a business model, because I think that ultimately it's a better business model for the end consumer, for the general public, to be able to have access to this research.
Yeah, they point out that PLOS One, which is the most prestigious of the open access medical journals, handled this submission exemplary fashion. They reviewed it. They identified all the errors. They rejected it. You know, they did a good job. And it's not, as you say, it's not a problem per se with open access. The science article, you know, researchers also criticized because they didn't submit the paper to any print journals as a control. And therefore they can't really say if what the impact of the fact that these journals were open access had on the poor or non-existent peer review. If they had sent it to 20 or 30 print journals, you know, across the prestige spectrum, that would have been some useful information as well.
And with that in mind, we should note that, you know, this is a study done by Science, which is a journal and therefore does have some money in this game as a journal that is not an open access journal.
So, I mean, there are incentives no matter what your business model is. If your business model is to charge researchers to print their paper, then your incentive is to accept and print a lot of papers. And that may provide a perverse incentive to have very limited or no peer review and to just publish a lot of crap. If you are a print journal and you make your money from subscriptions and you need to have high impact factor, and you get that by having new outrageous findings and not print, you know, boring replications or things that reinforce or establish what's already known. And so that creates a different kind of perverse incentive to publish those kind of papers, which are actually the most likely to be wrong because they're venturing into new area and they're saying something that's maybe a little implausible or a little unusual. So that's like the arsenic paper. So the arsenic paper that Science published, that's exactly the kind of paper that a print journal that's trying to pump up its impact factor, that's the kind of mistake they would make. So we are trading one set of perverse incentives for another, but it does highlight that the whole system needs careful peer review. We need to really examine the quality control that's in place at multiple layers. And the worst aspect of this whole story is that what it shows is that the published scientific peer-reviewed literature is flooded with crap. You have to wade through that crap to find the studies that are actually quality, which makes it challenging for the public, who may not have the background knowledge, to wade through the crap and find out what's valuable. It's also exacerbated by the fact that the internet allows for the rapid dissemination of crappy studies that have interesting headlines, and the erosion of the science journalism business model means that a lot of science journalism is just reprinting press releases from these crappy journals who are trying to lure in, you know, scientists to publish more papers in their journals. So essentially, there's a ton of crappy science misinformation out there. And the usual traditional checks and balances of having barriers in place that are meant to serve as quality control have really eroded at multiple levels. So, you know, we're just left with, I don't know, skeptics, science bloggers, you know, trying to set people straight.
That's exactly why I'm more forgiving of the problems that come with open access. Because when I say that the benefit of open access is that the general public has access to them, I don't necessarily mean just your average man on the street, you know, fact checking a New York Times article for the fun of it. I'm talking about science bloggers. When a BS paper comes out, whether it's in a print journal or an open access journal, the most interesting thing is the response to it. And science bloggers are, I think, generally better than the peer review process when it comes to tearing apart research to find what's wrong with it, what's right with it. And so open access journals better allow the bloggers to do that.
Yeah, I mean, for now, I don't mind that there's both models are out there. I think both are experimenting with ways of dealing with the internet and new business models. I'm not going to prejudge what's going to ultimately work out. You know, I think we're too much in the middle of this transition to really predict. But I do like the open access model, certainly. I love being able to just go and get access to a full article that I could link to and know other people can also get access to the full article when I'm talking about it. Yeah, absolutely. All right, Jay, you're going to finish up the news items for us. You're going to tell us about a new class of smart metals.
Have you guys heard of martensites?
Is that a person?
It was named after a person. It's a classification of material, and these materials change their crystal structure depending on their temperature. And this article that Steve was talking about, there's a new alloy that's been reported in the Journal of Nature by University of Minnesota scientists in the Aerospace Engineering and Mechanics Department. So most martensite metals are made of a mixture of nickel and titanium, and they can have sort of like a memory of their original shape. And this property is called shape memory. You've seen them used as an example with like that eyeglass commercial where the guy bends the frame and the metal goes back into shape. That's what these metals can do. And after the repeated shape changes, though, the existing martensites we use today, they build up stresses that accumulate over time inside the metal. It's kind of like it's degrading as every time it has to reshape itself. And that's what makes the new alloy incredible, is that the properties of it regaining its original shape could last a very long time. And one number I read said it was over 16,000 times this could be done. The fact that these metals are heated and cooled And during that process, the metal will rearrange its molecules and take on a different property. So it's a very seemingly very strange and even unnatural thing that's happening, but it is happening, and it is a very useful thing that they've discovered. So the University of Minnesota scientists combined zinc, gold, and copper in very specific proportions to optimize some of these qualities. And this incredible thing about it is that their alloy can be heated and cooled and reform itself over and over and over again. And of course, if you think about it, like all the applications that could be used in, you know, think about like space vehicles, electronics, jet engines, you know, anything where there's a lot of temperature change and you want the material to remain strong and to last as long as possible.
Yeah. I mean, jets get metal fatigue from having to go, you know, up in the atmosphere and then land over and over and over and over again. That's what they do. So they inevitably develop metal fatigue. So this kind of material would be perfect for that.
Yeah. They were saying, Steve, that they'd call it like smart mechanisms, where the temperature change could be, say, in a battery, where if the battery gets too warm, the smart mechanism would respond to it, and it could reclaim some of that heat energy and turn it back into electricity to recharge a battery, as an example. Or the same thing that happens in your laptop. Your laptop has a cooling process where they'd think things on this scale would be able to reclaim a lot more of that heat energy.
Yeah, material science is one of those things that we kind of take for granted, but it's a huge impact on modern technology, but often doesn't get attention that it deserves, you know?
Yeah, I feel like these types of things happen in the background. I wanted to mention this one. You know, it's a quick news item, but it is really interesting, and lots of things like this are happening all the time.
Yeah.
But like you said, like, we're not really paying a lot of attention to it, but man, are companies very much enthused about creating new materials that are used. I mean, just think about the stuff that we're using today, the materials that we have today, like Gorilla Glass as an example. I mean, everybody's got a piece of Gorilla Glass in their back pocket now on your cell phone.
I don't.
Most of us do.
Well, everybody and, who is somebody. Sure don't?
I have a burner phone.
Yeah, it's because of those drug deals. You got to just drop that phone and get rid of it.
Yeah, well, you know.
All right, Jay, thanks. All right, Evan, get us up to date on Who's That Noisy?
Yeah, let's do this. Let's play last week's Who's That Noisy. Here we go.
To have this horrendous event when, in fact, the official story is a lie is just totally, I don't have words for it. It's like a crime against humanity is what it is. Not like, it is.
Why do I get the feeling that guy's talking about bullshit?
Yeah. That was the voice of Stephen Earl Jones. No, not James Earl Jones. Stephen Earl Jones, an American physicist. He came to greater public prominence after the 2001 September 11 attacks, claiming to have evidence that showed the World Trade Center towers were destroyed, not by the two aircraft deliberately crashed into the skyscrapers, but rather by controlled demolition. He is famous in the 9/11 Architects for Truth movement. So, yeah.
I still, after all these years, I don't get it. I don't understand how they could think that the government would first fly the planes into the Twin Towers, but also have them rigged to explode to make absolutely sure that they collapse. For what purpose? I just don't understand why crashing the planes in there wasn't enough.
So they had an excuse to go to war?
But why, yeah, but why the demolition? Why complicate the plan that much? Who was the person who said, hey, let's also spend weeks rigging the towers and then blow them so that they to make sure that they collapse and hope that nobody finds any evidence that it was a controlled demolition?
Because, you know, because if the buildings don't go down, then we won't have a good enough reason to go to war. So they've got to come down for sure.
And let's orchestrate this perfectly so that physicists will be completely fooled, but losers in their mother's basement watching footage over and over and over again will totally get it.
See,
this.
Rebecca, that's the false flag. See, that's the real deception, is they put the fake conspiracy theorists out there to make conspiracy theories seem crazy.
Oh, right.
Oh, my God.
That's true. False flag operation.
There you go.
And despite tremendous evidence to the contrary, Jones has never moved away from this theory of his. So, so much for, you know, his career as a physicist. Yeah, he's retired, actually. They put him on paid leave. He was a professor at Brigham Young University, and I guess his after-school activities eventually caught up to him. Yeah. They said, no thanks, we're kind of done with you now.
That's like submitting a grant request in crayon.
I bet. In any case, there were several correct answers this week, but only one winner. There can be only one. Dan Pallera, you are this week's winner. Congratulations on guessing that that was Steve Jones.
Good job, Dan. What do you got for this week?
Here we go. Turn up your volume a little bit. You're going to want to hear this one. Interesting noise. Here we go. The thing you're going to want to know about this one, here's your hint, is that it's an audio recording of a major event in the world of science that took place earlier this year. And it's rather significant, which we'll talk about next week when we do the reveal. But that's your hint for the week. Search around the intertubes and see what you can find, and then submit your answer. And you can send us an email, wtn@theskepticsguide.org, or go ahead and log into our forums, sguforums.com, and place your answer there. Good luck, everyone.
Thanks, Evan. Well, we are here at TAM 2013, and we are joined now by Marty Klein. Marty, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Delighted to be here.
And Dr. Klein is a sex therapist and an author of 7 books, including Sexual Intelligence, What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It, and America's War on Sex. So, Marty, I'm a sex addict, and I need your help. So how can you help me?
I can help you by giving you the good news that you're not a sex addict.
Well, how do you know?
There is no such thing as sex addiction. Sex addiction is morality dressed up as clinical science. Sex addiction is a concept that was invented in 1986 by Patrick Carnes, a prison addictionologist. And
is that a real thing, addictionologist, or did he make up that term?
I think an addictionologist is a guy who specializes in addiction.
Works for okay. me.
It just seems a little hokey, right?
It does, yeah. it does yeah. come off as a little hokey, but okay.
It's like an athlete buy. Is a guy who wears an athletic support. the thing with sex addiction, lots and lots of people make sexual decisions whose consequences they don't like. And people make the same mistake over and over again when it comes to sexuality. Mm-hmm. And we don't need a new category for that. We already have categories for that. I mean, lots of people, lots of human beings, they make decisions. They don't like the consequences. They keep coming back and doing the same thing. So historically, therapy has a good category for that. It's called neurosis, right? Mm-hmm. More popularly, people say, oh, that guy, he just doesn't learn from his mistakes.
Yeah.
I think the attractiveness of the concept of sex addiction is that it allows people to say, it's not me, it's my addiction. Okay. It allows people to say, there's something damaged in me that drives these decisions. Rather than somebody saying, you know it's not good for me to do that, but at the time, it's very hard for me to think ahead. Mm-hmm. It's very hard for me to think about consequences when I'm really hungry or tired or lonely. It's hard for me to think of consequences when I'm angry at my wife. It's hard for me to think of consequences when I feel unattractive. And I got a lot of compassion for people like that. It's part of my job. But to call it an addiction, I think, waters down the meaning of the concept of addiction so mm-hmm. much as to render it meaningless. Mm-hmm.
But what about, are there people who are very compulsive in
yes,
terms of their sexual behavior
absolutely.
To the point where it's detrimental to their well-being, their functionality?
Of course.
Does it ever get to a level where you think it's reasonable to call that kind of compulsive sexual behavior a sex addiction, or would you just use a different term?
Well, I see people who wash their hands 40 times a day.
Yeah.
I don't call them hand-washing addicts. I say they have obsessive-compulsive disorder, and I don't send them to a hand-washing clinic. I help them get their obsessive-compulsive disorder treated. Mm-hmm. Practically any behavior on earth can be done in a compulsive way. in a self-destructive way, in an impulsive way. Certainly, we see people use the internet in self-destructive ways all the time, as well as shopping or a lot of other things. To separate out the content from that and to focus on the content, I think, is a really big mistake.
Well, what about the idea, though, that we absolutely do have like a sex drive? You don't have like a hand-washing drive, but the sex drive is something that you can feel come and go, right? You can feel exceptionally aroused or horny, right?
Yeah. Randy.
And I, as an example, though, I have a friend, a guy that I'm really close with that is like the horniest person that I've ever met in my life. Like he talks about sex incessantly and he's horny all the time.
That's your brother. You're getting confused.
Could you believe that? I'm trying to get.
UJJ has a friend.
Friend, yeah.
Yeah, a friend in scare quotes.
Oh,
yeah.
It's not me. Yeah. I always like said to him and other people that know about it that he's a sex addict. Like he's just over the top. Like he wants to have sex all the time.
Right. So I see these guys in my practice all the time. They come in and they say, I need to have sex twice a day. I say, so you want to have sex twice a day? They say, no, I need to have sex twice a day. That's the mental construct where it starts. I need to have sex. No, you don't. I mean, let's be serious. You don't need to have sex twice a day. You need to eat twice a day. You don't need to have sex. What this guy really means is when I don't have sex twice a day, I feel really, really uncomfortable. Really, tell me all about that. Mm-hmm. I feel lonely. I feel unattractive. I feel I'm not a real man. Well, I have a lot of sympathy about that. And that's not a sex addiction. It's not an addiction of any kind. It's not even about sex. It's about how a person feels about themselves or how a person sees themselves walking through the world. And fortunately, we have clinical tools to deal with that. They're called therapy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's a coping mechanism. You need to
typically. Yeah.
So it sounds like what you're saying is sexual behavior could be a compulsion that's a manifestation of another underlying psychological problem.
Of course.
And so it shouldn't be singled out. The behavior itself isn't the problem. It's just a symptom of the real underlying problem.
And what happens is, you know, Bob, you mentioned a coping mechanism. Yeah. So there are people, for example, their coping mechanism is to be on the board of their church and the PTA and the homeowners association and five other boards. That's their coping mechanism. Other guys, their coping mechanism is to work 88 hours a week. The difference with sex as a coping mechanism is that because our society is so nutty about sex, when the coping mechanism is about sex, society focuses on the sex. When the coping mechanism is about other stuff that's more socially approved, people don't get so nutty about it.
Mm-hmm. So, wow. So why is there such a big bugaboo about sex and morality? Why is that such a focus?
Well, sexuality is a vehicle for people to experience and express their autonomy. And if you were running a church, let's just say, or if you were running a government, let's just say, you wouldn't be so wild about people having this simple, low-cost, dependable way of accessing a sense of personal autonomy. I mean, it's the church's worst nightmare. So throughout history, every big institution has always tried to control people's sexuality, to control fertility, to control who's eligible for sex, what parts of the body are eligible. All of the mental maps that people have about sexuality, every religion wants to control that, and every government wants to control that. Even in 1984, the book by George Orwell, even in there, you know, Big Brother was trying to control people's sexuality.
Yeah.
Marty, since the perception of sex is so different between different countries, do you find, say, more self-described sex addicts in the United States than, say, United Kingdom?
Well, the difference in the rate of sex addiction between the U.S. and other countries is not so much about behavior. It's about the social concept of sex addiction. Just like some countries have a higher incidence of men. You know the old-fashioned word, henpecked? You know, mm-hmm. In some countries, they have a lot more of that, but it's not because the women behave differently as much as it's about some countries, they have the concept of henpecked and other countries don't.
Yeah.
So in the United States, of course, which is more sexually repressed than, say, Holland or Norway, we see more people self-identifying as sex addicts, more people getting identified by other people in their lives as sex addicts. I mean, in Sweden, if a guy wants to have sex with women other than his wife, they don't call him a sex addict. They call him Sven, you know?
Is this primarily a male phenomenon? I mean,
sex addiction? Well, again, I think a certain amount of it, I think most of it has to do with social expectations. women can express their sexuality in a lot of ways privately that other people are not going to raise their eyebrows about. And women typically don't usually go to prostitutes. Women don't engage sex workers typically, unless you count people who do their hair. So women don't engage sex workers. They don't read or they don't look at internet porn nearly as much as men. Men don't complain as much about women being too sexual. What men typically do when they're women are too sexual is they just withdraw from them. When women feel that men are too sexual, they tend to look for the pathology. They tend to, and I think this is all socially prescribed. Socially prescribed.
How about age? How do you treat someone?
I'm in favor of it.
Well, 18 versus 58. I mean, what kind of differences are we looking at? And do you handle patients differently?
Well, you know, by 58, people are supposed to have accomplished certain developmental tasks. You know, by 58, you're supposed to know who you are and the way you express your sexuality in a healthy person. The way you express your sexuality is, you know, consonant with who you are, with what your values are. When you're 18, you still don't know what your values are. You still don't know who you are. So sexuality at 18, actually, is one of the vehicles that young people use to discover who they are. To discover what's important to me. Do I care about how something feels to the touch when I'm having sex? Do I care about whether or not I make an emotional connection with the person I'm having sex with? You know, for a lot of 18-year-olds, no one's ever sat them down and said, yeah, sex can feel really good in your penis, but you know what? Sex can also be a way to get to know somebody else, or sex can be a way to feel close to somebody. So not that it has to, but it can be a way. So at the age of 18, people are sort of learning about two things at the same time. They're learning about who they are, and they're learning about sex at the same time. And, you know, trying to solve two variables in one equation can be very complicated. At 58, we're supposed to know who we are, and we're supposed to know what we care about. Some people, they care about, do you treat somebody nicely? Other people, they don't care about, do you treat somebody nicely? Of course, at 58... we're struggling with the changes in our bodies that have occurred over the last 40 years. So we tend to formulate our vision of what sexuality is all about between the ages of about 16 and 23, let's say, in America anyway. But during that period of time, the body that we have, we only have that body for a very short period of time. The healthy body, the physically flexible body, the lack of chronic pain, all that stuff. The body that we have, when we're putting together our ideas about sexuality, we don't have that body very long, which means that the ideas that we have about sex need to evolve over and over and over again in our 30s, in our 40s, in our 50s. When we're in our 50s, we may not be able to use our favorite position anymore because of chronic pain. When we're in our 50s, we may have felt when we were 18, what a real man does is he gets on top of a woman in a heterosexual thing. What a real man does gets on top of one. By the time you're 58, maybe your chronic back pain prevents you from getting on top of your partner. So you have to make a new decision about what does it mean to be a man when you're having sex, when you can't get on top of a woman.
So you're thinking that it's typical that a lot of people just always use the type and quantity of sex that they had in those early formative years, and that's kind of the bar that they're always comparing their current sex life to?
That's very, very common. I mean, ejaculation is a real good example. When guys are 18, you know, it's real easy to ejaculate. In fact, people are ejaculating all over the place when they don't want to. Listening to a podcast, you know, guys are ejaculating. So it's real easy to ejaculate when you're 18. When you're 58, it's not so easy anymore. You could have the most perfect stimulation in the world. It's just not that easy to ejaculate when you're 58. So you could decide, well, that's okay. Or you could decide, uh-oh, what's wrong with me? And you might actually go from woman to woman to woman in a desperate attempt, not because you're a sex addict, but you go from woman to woman to woman because you want to find a woman with whom you're going to ejaculate. And then you feel like, okay, I'm sexually normal.
Yeah.
Most people are desperate to feel sexually normal. And if the way you define sexually normal is sex the way it was when I was 19, oh, you're in big trouble. Mm-hmm. You're in big trouble.
We've tried to avoid, I think, the term normal in a lot of discussions we have about, you know, this topic and other topic. I think normal itself kind of has, you know, become a little bit of a taboo in a sense. Like, what is normal? You really can't define that, and you really shouldn't be using that term.
And yet people do.
Yeah. Right. Of course they do. Yeah. It's nomenclature. It's It's our fallback. I mean,
it does speak to, when we say normal, you know, we're basically saying what, the average?
There's more, there's more of a connotation though than just average.
There's because, a moral dimension
yes,
to it.
Yes, because the opposite is abnormal. It's not just, you know, atypical or there's gentler terms that are, but when you're a therapist, you deal more with healthy, you use the term healthy.
Right.
And versus, you know, counterproductive or unhealthy behavior, that's sort of what has the more of the right connotation.
Right. My patients don't, but I do. I mean, they desperately want to be normal. And when I'm training other therapists, I say, don't help your patients feel normal. Mm-hmm. You know, somebody comes in, I like to have sex with a chicken. Well, somebody comes in and says, you know, I like to have sex with the lights on, or I like to have sex with the lights off, and I'm afraid I'm not normal. What most therapists do is say, oh, sex with the lights on? Oh, don't worry, that's normal. The problem is that what the patient's not telling us is that they're into having sex with a chicken, right? Mm-hmm. So what patients really need is not to feel normal, but rather to get off of the normal, abnormal merry-go-round.
Yeah. Yeah.
The question is not, is your sexuality normal? The question is, does your sex work for you and for the people you're having sex with?
Yeah.
Is it consonant with your values as a person? And what normal sex is going to look like for somebody when they're 50 is probably going to be very different from what it looked like when they were 20. So we just have to get rid of that idea about normal altogether. Most people have not learned to trust themselves enough sexually. Most people certainly have not learned to trust their bodies enough sexually. So if you're with somebody and you're really excited, but you don't lubricate, that doesn't mean that there's something wrong. Doesn't mean you don't love the person. It may be that your body's just not lubricating. Now, yeah, let's go have sex anyway. But a lot of people haven't learned to trust their bodies when it comes to sex. And so the first explanation they go to, the pathology explanation is, you know, what's wrong here? And we got to get people off of that normal merry-go-round thing.
Marty, do people actually have sex with chickens?
Well, let's just say if you don't want to do it, you don't have to do it.
But that's a thing.
I mean, did you ever have someone come in and say, yeah, I'm banging a chicken?
Well, no.
I got to know.
No, but let me tell you this. I have, when I train therapists, you know, they say, well, how do you deal with patients who express their sexuality in ways that you don't have experience with? So, you know, I've never been pregnant. I have to talk about what's it like to have sex when you're pregnant. Or I've never been in a wheelchair, but how do we talk to people about having sex when they're in a wheelchair? And when people are into some sort of fetish or paraphilia, how do you talk to people if you've never had sex with a chicken?
Right.
You know, and somebody comes in and they say, I fantasize about having sex with a chicken. And what I say to my students is, well, put yourself in the place of a person who's into having sex with a chicken. How would you feel? You would feel lonely. You would feel embarrassed. You would feel guilty. You would feel, I can't tell anybody about it. You know, Monday morning at the water cooler, people are talking about what a great weekend they had. You know, you can't say, yeah, and I had sex with this, you know, Rhode Island Red. So, so there are things, most people don't have sex with chickens, but when people are being sexual or when people have sexual fantasies, if you can look at that as just part of the human parade, if you can not segregate sex outside of people's lives, but actually think about it inside of people's lives, then we can think about people feeling guilty or people feeling ashamed, or for that matter, people feeling connected. You know, somebody might say, when I fantasize about having sex with a chicken, I feel smart, I feel powerful, I feel capable. Mm-hmm. Well, we can all relate to that.
Sure.
You know, and then the question might be, you know, are there other ways that you can feel smart and capable during sex and maybe do it with somebody a little bit closer to your own size?
Yeah.
I have two related questions. One is, do you get patients who come in wanting to be quote unquote cured of their homosexuality? And two is, do you have patients who confess to being a pedophile and want to be treated for that? And what are your thoughts on that?
Well, as far as the gay thing, I practice in the San Francisco Bay Area. So we don't get a lot of people who are complaining about being gay. You know, mostly they're glad they live in the San Francisco Bay Area. So no, I've actually never had some. Now, I've had a lot of people who say, I'm into such and such and I don't want to be into such and such, which leads into your question about pedophilia. Yeah. But to talk about something a little softer first, you know, there are people who say, I can't get off unless the woman's wearing black leather boots and is smoking a cigarette and dropping the ash on my balls. Mm-hmm. You know, and I'd rather that not be my sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. Turns out it's really hard to change somebody's sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. My approach is always to expand somebody's sexual vista rather than change it.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I want to clarify one thing. So it seems to me that what you're saying is a lot of sexual desires and behaviors are driven by some other, you know, underlying psychological issues, and it's not about the sex. But are there also people who have paraphilias, or you said fetishes, that are about the sex? It just happens to be something, the way their brain's hardwired or whatever, just something makes them really sexually turned on by shoes or whatever it is. That's not about some other deeper issue. It's just about the shoes. Is that also the case?
You know, that's a good question. And I don't want to be disingenuous, but the answer is it depends on who you ask. Because there are some people who will tell, some professionals will tell you, having thought about it very carefully, that fetishes are always about something else.
Yeah.
I'm not of that opinion. I think that, and since we're probably not going to change somebody's fetish anyway, in a sense, it doesn't actually matter what it's about, but more it matters. So what are we going to do with this phenomenon?
Yeah.
The same way that, if you're a really tall person living in an apartment with a really low ceiling, what are we going to do about that?
Mm-hmm.
So, somebody comes in and fetishes typically develop very early in life. You know, ever since you were six, you liked mommy's high heel shoes,
mm-hmm.
and you used to like to caress them and kiss them when you were six. You weren't ejaculating when you were six, but you used to like to caress them and kiss them and maybe sleep with them under your pillow and this and that. By the time you're 14, now you like to ejaculate on them. And then when you're 30, you know, you like to be stepped on while you're masturbating or whatever mm-hmm. it is. So we could say high heel shoes on this program, right?
Absolutely.
So whether it's hardwired per se or whether it's wired in really, really early, partly that's a philosophical difference, but it's almost invariably wired in really, really early and notoriously difficult to change.
But you can develop a fetish, though. I mean,
is that right? Can you develop a fetish as an adult?
It doesn't happen very often. And if it does, you could almost say by definition, it's not a fetish. I mean, you could be trapped on a desert island, you know, for 30 years and all the women there are all 8 feet tall. And then you come back to Connecticut and the only women you're interested in are 8 feet tall. And then the question is that a fetish or not?
All right. Well, Marty Klein, thank you so much for sitting down with us. We really appreciate it. Fascinating talk. Author of Sexual Intelligence and America's War on Sex, among other books.
And my newsletter, Sexual Intelligence. You undoubtedly want to mention that.
And your website, which is, give us the URL.
Sexed.org. SEXED.ORG.
Thanks, Marty.
Thanks, Marty.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious, and then I challenge our panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have three regular news items this week. Is everyone ready?
Do it.
Yep.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Scientists have discovered the first evidence of a comet striking the Earth, part of a comet nucleus. Item number two. Researchers have discovered a method for inhibiting the propagation of prion proteins, potentially leading to a cure for mad cow and related diseases. And item number three, physicists have created stable exotic calcium nuclei with 20 protons and 34 neutrons, suggesting the existence of a previously unknown force operating at nuclear scales. Jay, go first.
All right, so this first one about the scientists that discover evidence of the comet striking the Earth. Steve, I'm not sure what the first question is even stating. They found part of a comet nucleus, and they think that that's the first comet that ever hit the Earth?
No, just the first evidence of a comet hitting the Earth.
What do you mean? Of course, don't comets hit the Earth all the time? You know, I mean, every 1,000 years or something? All right, I don't know. Okay, I really don't know. Sure, I could see that, you know, if it's not true that it's not relative, well, I guess it wouldn't be as common as I was making it sound like. All right. The second one about the mad cow disease, I totally believe it. No questions there. And the third one, the physicist creating the stable exotic calcium nuclei with 20 protons and 34 neutrons. Wow, that is pretty freaking awesome. I think the third one is the fake, the one about the protons and neutrons.
Okay, Rebecca?
Yeah, I'm kind of at a loss because I don't really follow. I'm not sure because for me it's between the prions and the calcium nuclei. I know very little about each. I hate to play this game, but I feel like if that had happened, I would have heard about it. Mm-hmm. And I have not heard about it. Potential cure for a mad cow and related diseases, I also haven't heard. But if it's just a potential cure for a disease that's honestly not really in the news cycle much anymore, then that makes more sense that that could have happened and I wouldn't have heard it. So for that reason, I'm gonna GWJ and say the calcium nuclei, the stable calcium nuclei is a filthy lie.
Okay, Bob.
Yeah, the comet thing, that makes sense. I think probably would be difficult to have solid evidence of that it was distinguishing a comet from like an asteroid hit. So that makes sense to me. The prion proteins, that would be great. I can't think of a reason why inhibiting the propagation of these proteins would be unreasonable or really, really surprising. The third one, I believe that they might have found some stable configuration of protons and neutrons that aren't common, but the fact that it might hint towards an unknown force makes me very skeptical. I would think we would have found some evidence of this unknown force much earlier than this seems to imply. So I'm going to go with that as the fiction.
And Evan.
Well, I guess I could stand out on my own and go with the comet nucleus one being the fiction.
Do it.
But everyone made some really good points, which is the advantage of going last about the calcium nuclei. But about the prion proteins, that seems like a huge advance here, inhibiting the propagation of prion proteins. I wonder how they did that. But I don't know. I just got to guess, go with one. Should I just go with everyone? Physicists have created a stable exotic calcium nuclei.
Join us.
I think I'm going to join you, but I think for maybe a little bit of a different reasons. Maybe perhaps they didn't create it. They realized that perhaps it actually exists in nature without manipulation from scientists. They found it somewhere, somehow, somewhere unexpected. So that's going to be my reason. I'm going with the team. Calcium.
Okay, I guess I'll take this in order. Scientists have discovered the first evidence of a comet striking the Earth, part of a comet nucleus. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Cool.
But of course.
So yeah, they found part of a nucleus of a comet that hit somewhere over Egypt millions of years ago. This is not like the comet that may have wiped out the dinosaurs. It's about 28 million years ago this one hit. More of a localized phenomenon. Probably exploded over what is now the Sahara. They also found pieces of fused sand from the heat. They said it probably would have induced a temperature of about 2,000 degrees Celsius and scattered bits of yellow silica glass over about a 6,000 square kilometer area. They say that they found pieces of this glass in jewelry, like ancient Egyptian jewelry. It's very pretty, like a yellowy-brown kind of crystal-looking thing. They call this comet Hypatia, after Hypatia of Alexandria.
Cool.
Oh, awesome.
She's awesome.
Yeah, I don't know how much we've spoken about her before, but yeah. And yeah, they talk about the fact that
it did not start the Chicago fires. Yeah.
It did not start the Chicago fires. That we've spent billions of dollars trying to get pieces of comets, you know, from space, when in fact there may be pieces of comets right here on Earth. Although I don't know if the pieces that we find here have the same scientific properties. Yeah, I was a little surprised that that was the first evidence of a comet impact.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that. All right, let's go on to number two. Researchers have discovered a method for inhibiting the propagation of prion proteins, potentially leading to a cure for mad cow and related diseases. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is also science.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, this is interesting. So you guys know about prion diseases. These are caused by proteins that are folded wrong, and they propagate by inducing the abnormal folding in other proteins, you know, the same type of protein. So it slowly spreads. And that's what Kujel-Diakov disease is, CJD, which is the human version of mad cow disease, or these are prion diseases. So it kind of simmers along for years, 15 years, 18 years. But then it gets to that threshold where it starts to spread very, very quickly, and it literally turns your brain into mush. It's called spongiform encephalopathy because your brain becomes very spongy.
Ugh.
Gross. Terrible, clinically very terrible disease. So what the researchers did was they took a recombinant form of the protein, of the prion protein, but without the attached lipids and carbohydrates, so just the amino acids, and they mixed that with the abnormally folded form of the prion, and it prevented it from propagating, from the abnormal protein from propagating. So this is all in a test tube, which means that it won't necessarily be useful as a treatment because there's significant hurdles in terms of application, which is why I said it could potentially lead to a cure. Just knowing that this works, you know, may one day lead to a treatment, it remains to be seen because we're still at the test tube level here. But that could be pretty exciting. There's, in fact, new or recent hypotheses that other diseases may, in fact, be protein folding diseases like Alzheimer's disease. That's actually a viable hypothesis these days, that Alzheimer's is actually a protein folding disorder.
I think that was in a previous science or fiction.
Is that right?
I swear we talked about that in the not too distant past.
All of this means that physicists have created stable exotic calcium nuclei with 20 protons and 34 neutrons, suggesting the existence of a previously unknown force operating at nuclear scales is fiction. Although the first half of that is science.
Wow.
Physicists have created a stable exotic calcium nuclei. And they did create it, Evan. They did not find it.
Okay.
Yeah, they had to, you know, smash stuff together to do that. Specifically, titanium 56 and scandium 55 to make calcium 54, which is one of these islands of stability. You know, it's the magic number. Why 54 protons and neutrons combined create the stability? That was really the mystery. And what they figured that it, not a new force, but just they have to consider the interactions among the nuclei, among the protons and neutrons, and not just one-on-one interactions, but like three-body interactions.
It gets real tough.
Yeah, which gets really difficult. So they're trying to model the interaction of the known forces at those scales to explain why this number is a magic number and why it sort of locks into this stable configuration.
Does exotic just mean it's an isotope?
Yeah, it's just an isotope that you're not going to find in nature, right?
Right, okay.
Yeah, you have to make it by smashing stuff together.
Mm.
But yeah, pretty cool.
Good stuff.
So good job, everyone. Good job.
Thank you. I went first, so I pioneered tonight.
Trying to
you.
Take the bulk of the credit, Jay.
Blaze the trail.
I want to take 99%. I will.
You can have it.
I'll distribute the rest to everybody else after the show.
Look forward to that.
Can you distribute a quote to us right now?
The claim of alternative practitioners to not treat disease labels but the whole patient allows alternative practitioners to live in a fool's paradise of quackery where they believe themselves to be protected from any challenge and demands for evidence. Edson Ernst!
Whoa!
Hey! Oh. Calm down there.
You got a good one.
I love it. I love Edzard Ernst.
Yeah, he's cool.
He is cool.
First professor of complementary alternative medicine.
And I'd like to thank a listener for sending in this quote tonight. His name's Stephen Novella, calling us or emailing us from Connecticut. Thanks, Steve.
You're welcome.
Hey, well done, Steve.
Yeah, Edzard's writing a blog these days, and that was a quote at the end of a recent blog of his. I think it captured that very nicely.
I have a quick announcement, if I may.
Yeah.
Rebecca, you stole my line. I was recently a guest on a new podcast that's out there called the Prism Podcast, which is hosted by my friends Grant Ritchie and Jason Luchtefeld. They are dentists from the Midwest, and they're also very keen skeptics. So they had me on their show. Check them out at www.prismpodcast.com. I am told the episode with me will be going up. Look for me on the podcast on October 14th. We talk about cool stuff like superstition and how best to approach people with skepticism, those who might be, have reservations for learning the skeptical mindset. So we had a good time.
One other quick Quick announcement. It is that time of year again for the Podcast Awards. Just pointing that out, if you go to podcastawards.com, you will see that they are open right now for nominations. They will be open for nominations until October 15th, 2013. So take the time to nominate your favorite podcast there.
Could be us.
Who knows? Who knows?
Yeah, you never know.
Never know.
Just saying. Just saying.
No way.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me all this week.
Thank you, Steve.
Anytime.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.
I'm very itchy. I'm dizzy. My wife yells at me, and help me, please. Can you help me? Please help me, please. Baby Jesus.